broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Thank you, Estelle. Coming up on today's show, Michel Temer has officially been sworn in as the President of Brazil following yesterday's impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. We'll be asking what impact this could have across South America.
The Donald Trump-supporting super PAC Rebuilding America Now has become the de facto media voice for the Republican presidential candidate. But just how controversial are the corporations funding this super PAC?
In a groundbreaking trial in Peru, General Wilfredo More Orzo has been sentenced to 25 years in prison for his involvement in the Acomarca massacre.
The date has now been set for the appeal against the legal ruling that the Norwegian terrorist Anders Breivik suffered a breach of human rights by being held in solitary confinement.
We've all considered a short layover while flying in order to save some cash, but one man was offered a ridiculously long layover, which resulted in some hilarious social media commentary.
And does a Swedish drinks firm hold the answer to the next soft drink craze?
All that and more over the next half hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus.
Votaram sim 61 senadores. Votaram não 20 senadores.
Brazil's Supreme Court Chief Justice Ricardo Lewandowski announcing the result of the final vote to impeach the suspended President Dilma Rousseff yesterday. 61 senators voted yes, 20 senators voted no. This means that Michel Temer, who has been serving as interim leader since May, has now been officially installed as the Brazilian president.
Temer's swearing in yesterday evening marks the end of a protracted battle to impeach Brazil's first female president, drawing to a close 13 years of Workers' Party rule in the country. Rousseff stood accused of budget irregularities and corruption, charges she has firmly denied, and whilst Michel Temer and his supporters say that this heralds a new dawn for Brazil, his opponents argue it's nothing short of a coup.
Following the vote, Dilma Rousseff released a statement saying, quote, "They decided to interrupt the mandate of a president who had committed no crime. They have convicted an innocent person and carried out a parliamentary coup." International reaction in the hours following the vote has been fairly muted, but Venezuela, Ecuador and Bolivia have now all recalled their ambassadors to Brazil in protest.
With me on the line now from Dubai is Guy Burton, co-author of Presidential Leadership in the Americas Since Independence. Thank you for speaking with us, Guy. The news that Venezuela, Ecuador and Bolivia have recalled their ambassadors to Brazil is probably not particularly surprising, but it's undoubtedly significant. That said, does it represent pressure being applied on Brazil's new administration, or does this actually play into the hands of growing moves to ostracize the Bolivarian alliance, specifically Venezuela?
I'm not sure that this will lead to a complete breakdown in relations between all of these different countries, because obviously the countries have to work together. And given the fact that Brazil is pretty much the largest player in the region, it can't really be ignored. So what I suspect you're going to see is a process of recalling ambassadors for sort of consultations, but eventually this will die down. Mm. As to whether this is going to ostracize Venezuela and the Bolivarian alliance, again, I'm not entirely sure, because Latin American politics has been, you know, characterized by this supposed leftward shift during the 2000s, and in the current decade, we've sort of apparently had a return of the right to government. Mm. But certainly the Bolivarian alliance is weaker without Venezuela's oil wealth behind it, given sort of the decline in prices. But I think the fact that, you know, all of the Bolivarian alliance governments have actually coordinated themselves in relation to recalling the ambassadors, I think reflects its durability.
Well, is there any truth then behind the accusations of a coup put forward by the likes of Venezuela, Ecuador and Bolivia? And if so, why do they seem so out on a limb internationally?
Mm. I think the claims of a coup have been distinguished where people sit in relation to this particular trial. You know, the left calls it a coup and the right says it's all been, you know, undone constitutionally. And I think that also reflects sort of a particular view of democracy, where the left sees democracy as very much sort of mass-based, the people being primary, and the right seeing it as very much sort of the parliamentary process and a sort of a maturing of democracy. So I think it's what's also quite interesting, I think, about this is how striking and in some ways concerning how that the language has become quite polarized between these two sides.
Mm.
I think it's also worth noting that, you know, coups in Latin America have tended to be historically military in character. So if you think about, you know, the removal of Allende in Chile in 1973, or the generals in Argentina in the 1970s, I think that's usually how most people perceive what a coup is. I think the left have sort of challenged that with this discussion, and I want, and certainly what I think we've seen at least since 2009 in Honduras and then in Paraguay in 2012 is this shift towards removing presidents by impeachment in the constitutional process. What is interesting as well is, you know, looking at Brazil back in 1964, where you have the removal of a president through, you know, a military means, but it couldn't have happened without there having been a sort of a mass conservative protest movement that took place there. And I think that's particularly interesting in relation to Venezuela, given what I've just been saying about the moves that are gathering pace to remove the president there.
You alluded before to the way in which politics in Latin America has been characterized over the last 15 years or so. Are we witnessing a trend in terms of governments shifting towards a more economically liberal stand? Or are these narratives of leftist administrations perhaps overplayed?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's necessary. I think what is interesting, I don't think we'd say it's completely overplayed. I think what is interesting is that, you know, when you had the economic changes towards neoliberalism back in the 1980s and 1990s, which were dominated by conservative right-wing governments, and then there was this broad claim that in the 2000s we saw the rise of the left and a shift away from that. And certainly Hugo Chavez in Venezuela was sort of seen as a standard bearer for this in 1998. When he first got elected, and then others followed in his wake. But I think even within the left, you know, there are significant differences. So I think the Bolivarian Alliance, you know, is characterized very much by this radical, populist, traditional left, if you want to call it that. And yet, within the left as well, we've seen, you know, much more social democratic, reformist, moderate left, if you want to call it that, associated with like Lula in Brazil between 2003 and 10, and Michel Bachelet in Chile. Of course, this was actually sort of a distinction that was put forward by Jorge Castañeda, the former Mexican foreign minister and scholar, back in about 2006. So, I mean, it was seen as very sort of stark, but it was very much sort of trying to say that there was something going on within the left, and it wasn't simply a case of left, you know, one thing or the other. And also, if we then look at the right as well, I mean, the right never really went away in the 2000s. So it's not just a case of that the right has come back. I mean, if you look in Mexico, for example, the end of one party rule and the rise of democracy occurred with the election and re-election of a neoliberal party, the PAN. And in Colombia, effectively, it's been, you know, the liberals and conservatives that have dominated the electoral process since the 19th century. The left have been nowhere. And finally, I think in Peru, I mean, despite all the populist identification of Ollantaya Humala with the left, I mean, he's very much governed in a manner which is similar to other, you know, to previous Peruvian governments since the 1980s, and that is very much a sort of a neoliberal approach. So I don't think that we're seeing a complete pendulum swing back and forth between left and right. There's changes happening within it.
Is it perhaps also that times have moved on and changed, in that the sorts of military coups that we've seen in years gone by simply won't work anymore, and that would explain a lot of the adoption of following the parliamentary procedure?
Yes, I think so. I mean, what I think is important, and this is what I said a little bit earlier, it's about sort of trying to seize the narrative here. So this is why you have, you know, the left and the right both making these claims, one side saying it's a coup, the other side saying it's a constitutional process. I think what's really interesting is how contested this is, and there's clearly no consensus at the moment. But, you know, let's come back. I mean, obviously, I talk as an academic. Let's come back in 10 years' time and see which claim, you know, wins out.
Guy Burton, thank you so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Still to come on the programme, the Donald Trump-supporting super PAC Rebuilding America Now has become the de facto media voice for the Republican presidential candidate. We'll be looking at the political power gained by those corporations supporting it.
In a groundbreaking trial in Peru, General Wilfredo More Orzo has been sentenced to 25 years in prison for his involvement in the Apumaca massacre.
The date has now been set for the appeal against a legal ruling that the Norwegian terrorist Anders Breivik suffered a breach of human rights by being held in solitary confinement.
Just how long a layover would you consider to save some money on your holidays?
And does a Swedish drinks firm hold the answer to the next soft drink craze?
The Rebuilding America Now Super PAC has been responsible for over $2 million worth of campaign videos promoting Donald Trump, or rather campaigning against Hillary Clinton, in the last 10 days alone. But revelations this week have highlighted the support given to the Super PAC and several other Donald Trump support groups from the rather controversial GEO Group.
The GEO Group is the second largest private prison company in the United States. It's also one of the major operators of for-profit immigration detention centres. The group itself has been at the centre of several controversies over the conditions of its prisons and detention centres across America. It was previously investigated by the Department of Justice, and a civil rights lawsuit alleged that juvenile inmates were being held in, quote, barbaric and unconstitutional conditions.
American alternative media group, Brave New Films, produced a short film highlighting the conditions in GEO Group institutions across America, a short clip of which includes Will Harrell, who investigated the prisons for the Texas Youth Commission, and a former inmate, Donald Weeks.
The Cope County facility was a facility run by the GEO Corporation. It was disgusting. There was an infestation of insects everywhere you looked, including the kitchen, insects in the food. It was horrible.
East Mississippi Correctional Facility, and it was run by GEO the first 2 months that I was there. It was dirty, nasty, unsanitary conditions. I mean, people get stabbed in there, they're bleeding, or they get in a fight and they're bleeding. They don't give no cleaning chemicals to clean the place up or nothing. The sewer kept backing up in the zones. The toilets kept stopping up. Stench was so bad in there, I couldn't eat anymore.
A small excerpt there from the Brave New Films video profiting from prisoner abuse. The GEO Group has reportedly earned over $1.8 billion from contracts with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, a division of the Department for Homeland Security, since 2008.
Earlier this month, the Department of Justice announced that it intended to stop giving federal contracts to privately run prisons, though Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has been a vocal supporter of private prisons, as can be heard during this MSNBC town hall debate from March of this year.
I think, our prison system is a disaster. It's a complete disaster. By the way, with prisons,
I think
we can do a lot of privatizations and private prisons. It seems to work a lot better.
Donald Trump there speaking on MSNBC in March.
It is not surprising then that the Donald Trump supporting Super PAC Rebuilding America Now has received funding from the GEO Group. There are many unconventional elements to Donald Trump's campaign, one being a lack of media content produced by the official campaign, and this has led to Rebuilding America Now becoming Trump's de facto paid media voice, described as such by The Intercept, who first published the financial accounts highlighting the GEO Group's campaign contributions.
The very nature of super PACs allows the candidates to distance themselves from any controversial donations and removes any limit on spending or donations. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Richard Painter, a professor of corporate law at the University of Minnesota, and I began by asking him just how a super PAC avoided financial constraints and exactly how corporations gained political power through their contributions.
Well, the super PACs have emerged in the aftermath of the Supreme Court ruling that prohibited Congress from regulating certain aspects of campaign finance on the premise that there's a First Amendment right to free speech. And what the super PACs do is take advantage of that ruling by saying that they are running their own ads in support of or against candidates exercising their right to free speech, and that they will raise money from whoever they please, and that they can raise money in unlimited amounts from whomever they please. And so we have large amounts of money being given to super PACs by corporate entities, by individuals, and others who want to support the super PACs. And yes, the candidates are not supposed to coordinate with the super PAC, but the candidates know what the super PACs are. They know who gives to them. And I believe that those contributions are likely to buy the same type of access and preferential treatment in government as people would get in return for a direct campaign contribution.
And what we're looking at right now with the reports of the GEO Group contributing to the Rebuilding America Now super PAC is that A multi-million dollar corporation, which profits from the incarceration of people, is then spending some of its profits lobbying for tougher laws, supporting candidates that have tougher laws to ensure that more people are going to prisons. It's a kind of perpetual cycle. Now, is there no laws that kind of forbid that form of lobbying, that forbid these corporations from having such a say in how elections are run?
No, there's also First Amendment right to petition the government, to lobby the government, and that is a common practice. And so many companies are simultaneously lobbying the government for what they want while also contributing money to super PACs and other entities that are engaged in the political process. This is very common across the board. We have a lot of it with the banking sector. A lot of it with the trial lawyers, the oil companies, and many other special interest groups in the United States.
Well, Professor Painter, thank you for talking to us today.
Well, thank you very much.
The former military commander, General Wilfredo Mori Orzo, has been sentenced to 25 years in prison by a court in Peru yesterday, the culmination of a five-year trial concerning the Ajumarca massacre of August 14, 1985. The court ruled that the events of 1985 were a mass murder carried out with the complete disregard for human dignity, with cruelty and contempt for civilian lives. And in addition to Mori Orzo, they also sentenced the soldiers who carried out the orders.
It should be added that those soldiers weren't actually present in the court because they can't be found at the moment. This is considered a groundbreaking trial, given that it's the only such case to bring charges against the entire military chain of command. The Ajumarca massacre has become known as one of the most infamous examples of human rights violations by the Peruvian state during the two decades of internal hostilities prior to the end of the last century.
During August of 1985, the Peruvian military massacred 69 unarmed civilians in the peasant village of Ajumarca in Peru, 12 men, 27 women and 30 children. Families of many of those victims protested outside of the court during the sentencing, which was initially scheduled for 11 a.m. but ultimately took until 7 p.m. to deliver. The Ajumarca massacre is notorious inside of Peru, but it's not particularly well known outside of the country, or at least in English-speaking countries.
Joining me on the line now from Lima in Peru to help us understand the situation better is Luz Maria Helguero. Thank you so much for talking to us. You've been covering this trial for some time. How has the verdict been received by the relatives of the victims?
You know, the relatives of the victims, they want to put in jail this person for life. But they receive, you know, 23 years, some ones, another the same. And also the jury said that the people, the military, they just pay reparation. And I think that the relatives are not so accord with this. Mm-hmm. And the people, the relatives said, you know, the people was waiting, the relatives, for more than 8 hours to begin the trial. Mm-hmm. And they were waiting 31 years to receive, you know, these results. And, you know, they said that they don't tell the relatives about how much time they were still waiting for this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, finally, at 2 a.m. in the morning, the jury, the trial finished, and the murderers received the results of the trial. But only one of the persons who commit the kill are in the room, because the others are not the people. They don't the government and the judge, they don't know where they are. So they are free. They're trying to find them, but only one will be in jail because the others, seven, are free, hiding in some place.
I understand as well that plans to build a monument in remembrance of the victims of the massacre are still facing problems. And more shocking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the remains of the victims still haven't been buried.
Of course. This is a shame. Let the people bury it, and let the relatives be waiting so much time. And in the day of the trial, they are waiting for eight hours just to begin the trial. is not fair.
Why has it taken so long, then?
Because the judiciary power in Peru is horrible. It's, you know, the judiciary power in Peru is very corrupt. Very, very corrupt.
Well, Lasse, I was just wondering, from the point of view of the relatives of the victims, does this mark the end of this chapter, or as it sounds from what you're saying, is this actually something that's still going to go on?
You know, they are waiting to see in jail all the people who killed their relatives. Only one of them will be in jail, but because the others are not, you know. Nobody knows where are them.
Luz Maria Helguero, thank you very much for talking to us.
Okay, bye-bye, thank you.
A date has now been set for the appeal by Norway over a legal ruling in April which found that the state had violated the human rights of the white supremacist terrorist Anders Breivik. Mr. Breivik is currently serving a 21-year sentence for killing 77 people and injuring over 100 more on the 22nd of July 2011. Most of those who were killed were on Utøya Island attending a Workers' Youth League summer camp run by the youth wing of the ruling Norwegian Labour Party.
The gun attack on Utøya Island took place shortly after Mr. Breivik set off a car bomb in Oslo. He then travelled to the island dressed as a police officer, killing children and adults indiscriminately. Mr. Breivik launched a case against Norway, claiming that the solitary confinement he was held in was a violation of his human rights. In April, the Norwegian courts found in Mr. Breivik's favour in a controversial hearing which split public opinion.
The judge found that Norway had broken Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights. A written decision stated that prohibiting inhumane and degrading treatment, quote, represents a fundamental value in a democratic society, and added that this applies in all circumstances. Norwegian authorities immediately launched an appeal against the ruling, and a date has now been set for January 2017.
Joining us on the line is Bjørn Ihler. Bjørn is a member of the Norwegian Labour Party and was on Utøya Island and came face-to-face with Mr. Breivik. He narrowly avoided being shot. Bjørn, thank you for joining us today. What was your initial reaction to the ruling in April which found that Mr. Breivik's human rights had been violated?
Well, so first of all, the fact that it was raised in front of the court in the first place meant that there was the potential of the outcome of the trial that we had, right? So there was a potential for Breivik to win. And I think the fact that he did pretty much shows that the juridical system in Norway, the legal system, was able to take his claims seriously and was seriously considering whether they were breaking human rights legislation or not. And that is an incredible sign of health within the Norwegian system. I think that really just proves that we also extend the same rights to Breivik as to everyone else, something I'm incredibly proud of in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And with the appeal process going through in January, they've now set the date for it next year. What are you hoping will be the outcome of that appeal process?
So my only hope really is that it will be a fair trial and that, principle, we will remain true to the principles that the Norwegian state was built on. So I think that's kind of the only important or really important part here. And if Breivik's human rights were violated, we should correct that. But that's up to the judge to say, not to me. So I look forward to seeing the outcome. But I don't have any specific opinion on like which side should win at this point.
Mm-hmm. Is that an opinion that's shared by many others that were involved in the horrific attacks? I know some media are reporting that victims' families are outraged by this. Do you think that that's generally true?
Well, I think there's some families that are troubled by this. And of course, it is incredibly difficult for all of us every time Breivik appears in court or in the media. Every time his story is told, it's going to rip up horrendous memories for a bunch of people. So I think a lot of those people are speaking out of the emotional place of pain from what happened rather than necessarily from the place of whether they think human rights are a good thing or not. I think there is consensus that human rights is something that should apply to everyone, but I can't really speak on behalf of anyone else than me. So keep that in mind as well.
Yes, of course. And just finally, I imagine the events on Utøya have had a huge impact on your life. And how much has this changed your view on terrorism?
So actually, surprisingly little. Because there was a reason why I was on Utøya in the first place, and that was my values, my views of human rights as universal, as human beings as equally valuable. And those were the reasons why I was a member of the party in the first place and why I went to the island. And that's what Breivik attacked, right? So I've remained true to my principles in kind of facing Breivik as well.
Bjørn Eider, thank you so much for talking to us today. Also joining us on the line is Anine Kierulf of the Norwegian Centre for Human Rights. Anine, just how strong do you think that Mr. Breivik's case is that his human rights were violated?
Well, clearly there's arguments to that effect. In the as the first instance court has said, it's a very well justified decision. But there are things to argue also against the way the first instance court decided that case. And it will be interesting to see how the appeals court deals with this question of what kind of threshold is required for this Article 3 in the European Convention on Human Rights that is has been considered breached. What is the threshold for reaching that conclusion?
Would you agree that the fact that this trial went forward in the first place is testament to the strength of a judicial system, and that it's important that any incidents of potential breach in human rights must be tried?
I do agree that even our foremost public enemies do deserve a fair trial and do deserve to have these questions tried in court. So, yes, I do think it's a good thing that his case is being considered. That I believe, even though I will not conclude on whether the decision is right or wrong.
Anine Kierulf, thank you very much for joining us today. Jack, you like to save some cash.
What are you implying?
Oh, you know what I'm implying. How long...
I really don't.
Well, how long a layover would you consider in order to save some money on your flights?
A few hours. I wouldn't mind having a drink and relaxing between flights.
Well, a customer called James Young, using the cheap flight site Skyscanner, was offered
other
a flight...
Other cheap flight sites are available.
They are, indeed. He was offered a flight with a 413,786-hour layover in Bangkok, which is apparently 47 years.
That does seem a little excessive. I'm not sure... I mean, that's a lot of drinking.
It is. It is indeed excessive.
You could make a life in that layover.
Well, Mr. Young posted the screenshot to Skyscanner on Facebook, asking exactly how they recommended that he spend that time. A woman called Jen, who was looking after the Skyscanner account, gave him a great array of suggestions.
It's not the worst place in the world to kill some time, though, I would have thought.
No, well, she had some good suggestions. She said that he could visit the Moon Bar, could take a cruise, and recommended a few places he could go to for dinner.
Did you not say something about this, having some funny time travel thing, though, when you saw this?
Well, yes. The 47-year layover still said that Mr. Young would land at his destination the day before he left.
I don't mean to break up the fun, Carolyn, but this is clearly just a software glitch.
Well, it might just be a software glitch, but now there are many conspiracy theories that Skyscanner have invented a time machine.
Yeah, but apps go wrong all the time. How many times does your computer break in a day?
Oh, let's not discuss that one.
And finally, the Swedes have never had a reputation for being boring, and Swedish foods have raised more than a few eyebrows amongst foreigners over the years, whether that's mixing jam with meat. That's the thing that's happened, apparently. Putting ketchup on pasta, you'd probably do that. Fish balls, fish spread, the list goes on. But now Swedish dairy Arla are set on launching a new range of fizzy drinks that will probably raise even more eyebrows.
Surely a fizzy drink can't be that weird, though.
Well, you say that, Carolyn, but now imagine that that drink was milk.
Touché, that sounds odd and disgusting.
To be fair, it's not the first carbonated milk drink to be released ever, but previous attempts by Coca-Cola and Britvic didn't work so well, especially Tango Strange Soda, which got pulled pretty quickly. And I don't know how many listeners are familiar with the drink Tango, but a milk-based Tango.
You know a lot about fizzy milk, Jack.
I've never tried it.
I don't think I ever want to. That makes me feel a bit ill thinking about it.
It would probably just taste like milk with air in it.
Yeah, I don't want to try. Let's not find out. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can listen to again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a moment we will hand over to Washington DC for the Tom Hartman Show, who will be with you for the next 3 hours, so stay tuned for that. Till tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.